Mr. Ron Atkinson, who is the rescue, will present part of his report.
May it please the court, this case involves a breach of agreement to farm out specific oil and gas leases in the Shelby Corzine Survey of Nacogdoches County. Those leases specifically were the LD Tire 519.60 acres and International Paper 182.5 acre tracts in the Shelby Corzine Survey. This case also involves the wanton and malicious violation of a fiduciary relationship between Blefco and Getty, and it further involves Getty's wanton and malicious bad faith in usurping a fiduciary opportunity to drill those acreages. A Nacogdoches County jury heard this evidence, heard this case. They found a contract, a breach of the contract, damages of $2 million. They heard the evidence of the wanton conduct, the malicious conduct, the breach of this fiduciary by Getty, and returned punitive damages of $4 million. Notwithstanding that, the Eastland Court of Appeals, an extremely brief, sketchy, and obtuse opinion, has not only reversed the jury findings, but they've rendered a judgment that Blefco take nothing in this case, and in doing so, they have ruled that there was no evidence to support the contract. If you review the evidence in the case, you will see clearly that the Court of Appeals has failed to follow the proper standard in reviewing the evidence. The proper standard to review in a no evidence point is that the appellate court must consider only the evidence and inferences in support of the judgment and disregard all evidence and inferences to the contrary. What I intend to do is to take every dispositive sentence in the Court of Appeals opinion and show you that it is wrong. And you start with the very first sentence of the opinion. The first sentence says that Blefco sued Getty for a breach of contract, period. That's not true. Blefco sued Getty for breach of contract, for fraud, for malicious and willful intent to deceive, and for bad faith. This misstatement of law is what started the Eastman Court down the road to error. They didn't understand the pleadings, and so they couldn't understand the effects of the jury answers. The next dispositive sentence is on the second page of the opinion, and the court says that the affirmative finding of the jury in special issue number one is as a matter of law supported by no evidence. The evidence that was in front of the court and that the jury heard were 9 documents, which when taken together and referred back and forth to each other, clearly show that there was an agreement between these parties and show what that agreement was. So that the Court of Appeals, by ignoring all of those documents and by only using 3 of those documents, has ignored the rule of law that's existed in this state since at least 1867, Patton versus Rucker. And that is that you can take all of these documents and refer to them back and forth to achieve the agreement. The very next sentence is also wrong. It says that Blefco's claims are based upon only the letter February 1, 1983. And they emphasize certain language in the opinion. That language is, provided a mutually acceptable agreement can be reached. We're going to see as we go through, the court uses that language to let Getty out of this contract. But you're also going to see that they ignore the evidence that the employee of Getty Oil Company admitted that when the man who wrote the letter, that when he wrote that letter, he doesn't mean what the Court of Appeals says it means. He said it simply meant a joint operating agreement. And in spite of that admission that the Court of Appeals has ignored, they reversed this case based upon that language. That statement that by the language providing a mutually acceptable agreement can be reached is found on page 536 of the Statement of Facts. The next dispositive sentence in the opinion is on page 3, where they say, where they refer to the letter of December 28th, and they say that the map enclosed with that letter does not have a meets and bounds description. That's true. But the court will refer to the exhibit that the Court of Appeals ignored, which was in evidence as plaintiff's exhibit number 4 at the trial. What the Court of Appeals ignored, and there are no evidence points, is that those leases were described to the hundredth of an acre. In a prior letter, which gave the lease name and its acreage to the hundredth of an acre. Attached to that was a map that had the acreage in question outlined And from it, you can see the name of the survey, and you can even read the abstract number. Court of Appeals never dealt with Plaintiff's Exhibit Number 4 in space to their no-evidence point on sufficiency of the description of the leases, because this letter supplies all the information from the face of the document that allows you to identify the leases under classic Texas law. This at least we know since 1867. So that sentence in the opinion is incorrect.
Where does it identify what the county is in? Is that on the map?
Yes, sir. Right. Located in Nacogdoches County, Texas, on the face of Plaintiff's Exhibit Number 4. Then they make another misstatement of the evidence. They say that it does not clearly show what acreages could be committed to each of the units. That portion of the sentence ignores the undisputed testimony of the Getty employee again. As you can see from Plaintiff's Exhibit Number 4, these acreages are enough for Getty to have its own unit. LEFCO's deal was a continuous drilling program of which Getty was an independent part. Their acreage was its own unit. And that's admitted by the employee Dove on page 114 of the Statement of Facts. So discussions of the initial unit are irrelevant to our discussion here, and the Court of Appeals failed to account for that evidence that Getty's unit was its own unit and had no other acreage in it. The next dispositive sentence says that Getty's letter, February 1, 1983, does not show that it had agreed to the initial drill site and unit for the test well. The Getty employee admitted, again on page 114, that when he wrote the letters that are the subject of this trade, that he set forth in these letters every term that he thought was essential to the formation of a farm out. And only those that are reflected in this letter are essential to a farm out under the admission of the Getty employee. What the court has done is substitute its own judgment and say that the initial drill site and unit design for the initial well was covered under this language of providing a mutually acceptable agreement can be reached. That's not only not supported in the evidence, it's directly contradicted by the admission of the Getty employee, who said no. What I meant by that was a joint operating agreement. The reason the court had to come up with its own interpretation of that language is because the Getty employee got chewed pretty bad in front of the jury. Come to find out, Getty had committed the same acreage to an AMI with city service and drill and dry hole. They didn't have a joint operating agreement there either, but they changed their half to dry hole jobs, which shows that they recognized a commitment without a joint operating agreement. So it became clear to the jury that when Getty was dealing with another major oil company, joint operating agreement wasn't important. When they're dealing with Little Blefco, that's the out they're going to use. So now the court has overlooked his admission that that's what he's meant and read other conditions into it that are not there. But the main point is that the employee admitted when he wrote these letters and set those terms, which is undisputed that the letters from Blefco matched exactly, that he set out all the terms he thought was necessary for a farm out. You'll excuse the crudity of the next exhibit, but it's a little hand-lettered exhibit that we've reproduced it for the jury in Nacogdoches to show that the initial unit designs and test wells with Grace are not important, because he said the Grace deal had no bearing on the Getty deal. So any discussion of initial unit designs and those terms not being agreed to apply to the Grace unit, the employee admitted that that had no bearing on the deal with Getty. Then at the bottom of page 4, in the next dispositive sentence, the court said that the writing signed by Getty's employee of February 1 is not complete within itself, even if you take two other letters with it.
Do you have the Southwest Reporter copy? Because that's what we have. At least that's what I have in front of me. And
I have a slip opinion.
You're referring to slip opinion.
I'm referring to slip opinion, which is what I have.
Okay. Well, we can find it, but just talk a little slower when you make a reference, because it takes a while.
Sure. Their next sentence is, the writing signed by Getty's employee is not complete within itself, but he never again deals with Plaintiff's Exhibit Number 4, which supplies that description of the property. Then it really gets to be interesting. because they say it does not contain all the essential elements to the agreement. The time has now come that this court is going to have, as you did in Birchfield versus Texas County Memorial Hospital, write a court of appeals and say, some while back, we adopted some rules of evidence and were serious about it. Because what's never mentioned in the court of appeals opinion is that we called a witness stand an expert, a lawyer and a landman, who had reviewed all these documents. And he was asked a question. Is that a binding agreement on the custom usage of the trade? And he said, yes, sir, they are. So either that rule is wrong, or I've got some evidence of contract. But more importantly than that, what the Court of Appeals terms as essential, things that are not covered in any of these letters, he said were secondary terms. And he took every one of those terms, and he explained them to the jury and said, this is how, if they could make an agreement, then an agreement would be reached. Where that sentence is further wrong is this. This court is ruling in Scott versus Engle Brothers Pacific that parties may have an agreement on a particular matter, knowing that in the future they will have to make other agreements that are incident to it. But in the meantime, the agreement that they have, or these terms attached in these letters, are enforceable. Scott versus Engle Brothers says that oftentimes you'll find that the other ancillary matters can only be decided within certain prescribed limits. It's exactly what the lawyer testified to. If custom and usage of the trade prescribed the limits that these ancillary matters could be decided in. Yet the Court of Appeals misapplies the standard of review and says we had no evidence to support the contract. You've got to reverse the case as far as the contract is concerned. And again, substitute their own judgment in the very next sentence, which says, part of the sentence, further, Gandy's letter was subject to a mutually acceptable agreement with reference to the details of the agreement, such as the location of the test well and the acres being included in the unit. The only place that position was ever taken was in the appellate's brief. It's not one time suggesting the statement of facts of this case that by mutually acceptable agreement they meant location of the test well or design of the initial unit. A Getty employee testified every time he testified, or at least he was impeached about it, that what he meant by mutually acceptable agreement was a joint operating agreement. So the Court of Appeals has substituted his own version of what that means to reverse this case. Then we turn to their next error, which is not an error of statement of fact, but is an error of analysis of the case that goes back to their first sentence. They next say, you can't get punitive damages for breach of contract. That's true. But you can get punitive damages where you plead and prove an independent tort. In this case, we plead willful and malicious intent to deceive and fraud. That was never accepted to. No special exception was ever made. The jury heard evidence to support that I'll talk to you about in a minute. There was an issue submitted. Was their conduct willful, wanton, and malicious? Gandy Oil Company made over 120 objections to the court's charge, an eight-issue charge, which brings into play the Monsanto case. But even more than that, when they got to those issues on punitives, you know what their objection was? You just can't get punitive damages in a breach of contract case. Now, they had an objection. The objection may have been, they could have had one, they just said, that's an improper submission of the independent tort. That doesn't submit fraud, and we haven't even accepted the other, but that's an improper submission. They didn't make that objection. So punitive damages submission is blamed under Rules 274 and 279 and Allen versus American National Insurance. Regardless of how, that's not a defective submission, but a sentence is defective submission. Regardless of how defective your submission is, if you don't make a proper objection to it, you're bound by it when the jury comes back. And that's exactly what happened to them in this case. The point of the issue is that under Fitzgerald versus Hull, which members of this court decided in seminar, says this. If you're a joint venturer, or you're even about to enter into that relationship, you owe to each other as joint venturers the utmost good faith and the most scrupulous honesty. When the jury found the contract to farm this acreage out, these parties became joint venturers. Even if there's not a contract, the evidence is clear they were about to assume that relationship. When the jury found the malicious breach of that relationship, that subjected these defendants to punitive damages. What evidence was there to support it? When the first letter was written, the letter was written to Getty, please farm out these acres. They said, we're committed to an area of mutual interest with city service, you can't farm it out. They went to city service to build a dry hole. They didn't have a joint operating agreement, but they still paid their half the cost. They dry hole, left them, went back, and said, we're putting together a 5-well program. We want y'all to be in it. You got enough acres to be on you. We want your acres. That set up through Getty, and this is what the jury saw, Class Exhibit 6L in the record of the case. This is the internal document that went through Getty. Every manager and every department okayed the farm out. Specifically referring to the dry hole and saying, we have no future plans to drill the acreage again and their leases were about to expire. They said, farm it out. Lefko went to drilling wells, sending Getty letters telling what was going on, showing them the geology. And for people that didn't have an agreement, they sat there and said nothing. They took the information. Then when they got our information, and we said, well, it's time for us to move in and drill, they said, you're not drilling there, we are. And went and drilled a well, but we had the X on the map. I submit to you that that's a breach of duty of good faith, and that's not the utmost honesty and fair deal.
I'm not trying to stop the train of thought, but I'm confused about something. On what issue of liability was the exemplary damage issue predicated upon?
On the jury's finding of wanton and malicious conduct. The submission that was actually made is, was there action in regard to this breach, willful, wanton, and malicious? That's the actual
issue. Was there action with regard to this breach?
Willful, wanton, and malicious. My point is, you wouldn't submit to the jury an issue and say, are they joint venturers? That's established as a matter of law. The question is there action in what they did in regard to their joint venture, willful, wanton, and malicious? That's the point of that matter.
But a malicious breach of a contract under Amoco is not sufficient to get you torpedoed.
Yes, sir, that's exactly right. But for that breach of companies, breach of fiduciary relationship, then you can't. And these people were, by the finding of contract, joint ventures, and therefore owed each other fiduciary. That then becomes the point and the reasons why you've got to reverse the case, both as to actuals and as to punitives. As to the contract, it's an absolute laydown. The jury found it, there's evidence to support it. More than that, the question then becomes, what course of action should you take when you reverse it? Well, on the contract, the action that you take is reverse and render. The reason is that Latta versus Transit Grain says, parties are presumed to contract on the basis of general customs and usages of their trade. The only evidence in the record is the expert call by the plaintiff as to what those are. There's no contrary evidence in the record. That kicks the presumption into effect. Then under Magro, where the defendants didn't offer any evidence to overcome the presumption, instead of as the Court of Appeals would have you believe, contract's actually proved as a matter of law. Because the only evidence that Getty put on to disprove the contract was the subjective intent of the employee that wrote the letter. And Williston on contracts will tell you that the subjective intent of a party in the contract is absolutely irrelevant. It is no evidence. You gauge contract by objective manifestation. And all of the objective manifestation, what was received in the letters where the terms of the offer matched up, or even in their own internal document, is that they're intended for there to be a contract and a format. Therefore, under MADRO, let them overcome the presumption, and there's no need to send this case back to consider anything else. It's established as a matter of law by their failure to overcome the presumption. Then as punitive damages,
Counselor, could I?
Yes, sir.
Back to Judge Spears' question as to the issue. Now, did you have an issue as to whether or not the joint venture agreement was breached?
Justice Wallace, the issue that was submitted only says in regard to this breach. And that admittedly is probably pretty protracted. But my point about that is that that could have been tightened up or that could have been talked about if the defendant made an objection. That's what we make objections for, and if that had been talked about, there's no opportunity to try to talk about that because one proper objection made to it.
Did this relationship that was contemplated or was entered into constitute a joint? Does it have all the elements of a joint venture?
Yes. Gannett's putting up acreage. We're putting up either acreage or expertise. In this case, it'd be the expertise and money to drill it. We're running the risk of drilling, all those attendant risks using theirs, and we're going to share in the profits. On the
sharing
basis.
Profits and sharing losses.
25% and 25%. That's the back ends that match up.
And I have the ability to bind each other. I mean, well, the elements of a joint venture are pretty well established. But you have to have the ability to bind each other and,
I don't think so.
And share in some predetermined scheme in profits and losses.
Well, here would be the... The terms is actually matched up. They have the nine letters show a course of negotiation. And after this first description here of the specific acreage, Getty wrote back and said, we call it, they say, West Stockman area. And the employee said, well, we call those specific leases the West Stockman area. So they start referring to it as the West Stockman area in Nacogdoches County. The negotiations wound up to be a petty test of 8,000 feet.
Counselor, some of us are a little old and we have a lot of time to eat.
Yes.
What exhibit is that?
This is, no, I don't have this one marked. I believe this is going to be, I can refer to it though, it's the letter of December 28, 1982. It doesn't have an exhibit tag on this one. It does in the record. This was a trial exhibit, and I didn't put the exhibit tag on. Trial jury address. It's the letter of December 28, 1982 from Glasgow to
6I looks like, can that be right?
It would be a 6 with some letter behind it. It'll be the only letter of December 28, 1982, and there'll be a map following.
We have that. It was distributed with the application.
Yes, sir. I brought what I used in front of the jury to try to aid the courts. It's an 8,000 foot padded test that you got to drill to earn. That matches up with the letter February 183. Then the other terms that match up are 75% net revenue interest to Getty, 25% total working interest after payout. And so those terms match up. I think in the February 1 letter may be expressed as what Blasco will get, it'll be the difference of 100%. But those terms, it's undisputed by Cornell Dove testified, the Getty employee admitted, that these letters all match up in terms. And that's all the terms he submitted, and that's the terms he said he had to have the farmer. And he admits that the letters match up. So that issue leaves the case at that point.
What's a land woman?
Justice Kilgore, that's not my language. I would think that would be a land person or a land man. But the document, of course, is signed by the person involved. So that's not my. I think that's the writer's letter language, not mine. Those are the terms that match up. And those are the reasons when you view this, it's mainly on punitive damages, the reason that you ought to render judgment is it's a waiver. Any complaint about punitive has been waived by the failure to make a proper objection. And any of these matters about loose language of what we could have done, we didn't have the opportunity to do because we weren't signaled to it by proper objection. and said they don't overcome the presumption under MAGRO, you ought to reverse and render the contract evidence.
Thank you, counsel. We will now hear argument from respondent.
May I please report? Mr. Todd, may I have you present argument for the respondent?
If your honor please, you will pardon me if my voice fails. I've been under the effects of recent flu. Talk about fighting, creating something of substance out of shadows. This case comes awful close to that situation. I'm amused at this point, the council is trying to now create a joint venture agreement between Diddy and Blavco. Certainly, joint venture was declared in the initial pleadings or the amended pleadings in which Lavco took a shot at Giddy on contract, breach of contract, tort, fraud, the whole works. If we came down to the time for Lavco to submit its case to the jury, the special issues that were submitted, all of the pleadings were abandoned except as to their plea of breach of contract. The issue that was submitted was there in fact a written agreement between the parties to form out. Was that contract breached? Question of punitive damages. The wanton disregard predicated on the breach of the contract was the breach of the contract. At this point, Lavco had completely abandoned its cause of action and claim for tort, and the court submitted only the question of breach of contract.
Were there two damage issues or just one damage issue?
The issue of damages went to what would reasonably compensate the plaintiff for the breach of the contract on past and present production from the existing well and then from the other formations. It was kind of a split finding on the actual damages.
But they're totally related to the contract.
That's right. And of course, there were some duplicative issues on the cost of drilling the wells that Giddy had incurred and the cost of operating the well, which was sought to be as an offset against the recovery of the profit of the offset of drilling costs or operating costs. But let's get to the heart of this lawsuit. As the Court of Appeals did so in their opinion. Quite often, and in this instance, you have a person engaged in the oil and gas business like Lavco that, as counsel says, they have the expertise and are willing to throw their expertise around if they can get someone to give them something, give them a foreman. What we had in this instance, this area in Nacogdoches, Giddy Oil Company had acquired, purchased, owned oil and gas leases covering approximately 600 acres. Five different leases, in fact. over several different tracts of land. Also in this area, Grace Petroleum Company owned blocks of leases in the area. Now, Blevco didn't have leases, wasn't doing any drilling, but they were setting about writing these operators in the area requesting farmouts. And so you find, out of the blue, Blevco writes Gideon, says, we would like a farm out on your acreage. They were also writing Grace Petroleum, asking Grace. The idea, of course, being that if I can get a commitment of a farm out, then I'll go out and try to sell this to somebody that'll do the drilling. Blevco didn't drill any wells in this area. The well that was drilled by Grace Petroleum. It was drilled on Grace's acreage only. In the correspondence, Blevco says, we have our five-well drilling program. Grace, Blevco, and Getty. And we want the Getty acreage to be committed to this. The response was, if we can reach an agreement, and in all of the correspondence of Getty employee, it is conditioned that providing a mutually acceptable agreement can be reached. Getty commitment, if we can reach these agreements, we must have a test well of 8,000 feet, test of peg formation. They did not agree to Grace being the operator or Grace being able to dictate the size of the unit or the formation of the unit. These were elements yet to be agreed upon. When you come right down to the question, as this was dealing with an interest in land, a request for a farm out, an agreement to assign or transfer an interest in land, we have the statute of fraud, which requires that all of the essential elements of the agreement must be reduced to writing, signed by the parties to be bound by it. Now, what is the agreement here? The letter of February 1st, 1983, from Getty to Blevco, says if we can reach a mutually acceptable agreement, we will farm out, but only the acreage in the initial well will be committed. Getty will reserve the right to either participate or farm out on all subsequent units of the wells. Now in this instance, Grace Petroleum drilled the Randall well. None of the Getty acreage was committed to that unit. By the express provisions of the February 1 letter, Getty retained the option to participate or farm out in the second wells or the subsequent wells. But the court was called upon to take these letters and apply the statute of fraud and compel performance. That is, the court, under the plaintiff's prayer for specific performance, says, now I am going to enter an order directing Getty to perform in accordance with the statute of fraud and the written agreement of the parties. I am going to enter an order requiring Blevco to perform under this written agreement of format. what would the court be able to enforce? First of all, none of the oil and gas leases are identified. None. Second, at what point must BLEFCO commence drilling operations? Nowhere is there a written agreement saying when the drilling will commence. At what depth must BLEFCO drill? The letters bounce back and forth between 10,200 feet, another instance, 8,000 feet, another instance to test the pit formation at 8,000 or lesser feet. At nowhere have the parties agreed upon these essential elements of the contract. There was no meeting of the minds. And this, of course, goes to the very heart of this lawsuit. There was negotiations. There was requests. There were letters. But at some given time, under our freedom of contract, the parties' minds must come together on the essential elements of the agreement. This was never done. The requirement of a contract to deal with an assignment or transfer of interest in land, the statute of fraud, requiring all the essential elements be in writing, does not exist in this case. And it is for this reason that from the very outset, Gidley Oil Company has taken the position that although there was negotiations, although there was correspondence, there was never a meeting of the minds on the agreement. And what letters and what correspondence you have is conditioned upon the parties mutually reaching an acceptable agreement. We believe that the opinion of the Court of Appeals is correct. It goes to the heart of the lawsuit. There is nothing in our rule of law which requires people to assume a certain standard in trying to reach a contract or agreement. BLEFCO would like to put some kind of duty on Gay Oil Company to negotiate in good faith. Gay was not requesting anything of BLEFCO. All requests came from BLEFCO to Gay. And every commitment, every response, Gay says, we will provide a mutual acceptable agreement is reached by the parties. There was no meeting of the minds. There was no coming together on the essential elements. There was no compliance with the statute of fraud concerning the leases. And for that reason, we believe that the Court of Appeal opinion is correct. The record clearly shows that in this instance, there was no evidence to support the jury's finding of a binding contract or a breach of that contract.
Counsel, are you saying that in order for there to be a legally enforceable farm-out agreement that you have to incorporate in that agreement all of the leases and show their meets and bounds description?
You have to be able to identify the lease that you're speaking of. Most instances, of course, you refer to the lease by parties, date, by reference.
You can't do that just by map.
Not by map, or by saying area. West Stockton area, part of the county.
Well, farm-out agreements have been pretty loose in the past. As you well know, you've seen a lot of them.
And as pointed out by the author in the Daily Law Review article, they caution the industry in this respect. Sure, it's loose. It's pointing out that this is the handshake business. But it points out that you're leading yourself to all kinds of trouble in litigation. unless you can file a dispute of fraud. And of course, that is the reason we've got the statute of fraud. Prevent this kind of dealing with valuable property rights that's based upon some landman's statement that's going to commit 600 acres of valuable lease properties. And of course, it is so important that when a landman is writing this kind of letter, that there is precaution provided an acceptable agreement can be reached, contemplating that the formal instrument itself be signed off by both parties, be prepared so that somebody with authority can review and can enter into this type of agreement. The correspondence only contemplated that the parties would come to some agreement in the future, which never occurred. And of course, an agreement to make an agreement in the future is not enforceable. Thank you.
Thank you, Council.
Counsel, before you start, would you first clear up whether or not you went to trial on only the pleadings of breach of contract, or you had other pleadings active in there?
No. We went to trial on pleadings, breach of contract, and they admitted fraud and malicious intent to deceive. They didn't special accept on one of those, and I'll show you the evidence that we introduced them. For instance, we proved in the latter stages of the trial that Mr. Dove, I went to all the trouble, and to show you whether we were alleging fraud and alleging the breach of this relationship. In the latter stages of the statement of facts, you'll see where I proved when I first visited Mr. Dove at the courthouse, he claimed he had a heart attack, couldn't attend his deposition. So we put it off. Then when he shows up a month later, or a month and a half later, he's forgotten about it. He admits he didn't take the sick time off from his job. He admits he didn't take any vacation time. He can't remember the name of the doctor that treated him. He can't remember the hospital he went to. And he's got five documents missing out of his file. Now, does that sound like a lawyer that went to trial just on a breach of contract? Where were all these objections at the trial court? Well, they're supposed to be made. They weren't there. They assumed that was only a breach of contract cause of action. Now, the most cogent point that's been raised has been Justice Ray's question about is there a separate finding of actual damage? But there can't be, Justice Ray. This is a unique case in oil and gas business where if you submit your damage on loss of production, that's all the damage we would have suffered. Damage from the breach of the contract is exactly the same as the damage from the breach of the covenant of good faith. I don't have any special damage from the fraud or from the breach. There's no way that I can answer it. You can't imagine another element of damage element that I can come up with. To ask that's peculiar to the breach of the fiduciary relationship as opposed to the contract.
Mr. Atkinson, tell me what you consider to be more than a scintilla of evidence that there was a farm-out agreement in writing between Blevco and Getty.
If nothing else, Justice Bill Garland, it's the testimony of the expert witness where he said, I have reviewed these documents, and they form a valid and binding commitment between the parties to farm out. If there's nothing else, that's evidence of contract.
And it's your contention that under the rules of evidence that an opinion as to the ultimate fact is admissible?
Even if it involves a mixed question of fact of law, that's Burnsville versus Second County Memorial Hospital.
Now, was the answer objected to at the time of trial?
Yes, it was objected to. But there's more than that. These letters, December 28th, the question was asked what depth we had to drill to? 8,000 feet. It's the same on this letter as it is on the letter February 1, 1983. But what they can't get around is the Getty employee admitted at the trial that in writing these letters, he put in it the terms that he said was necessary to achieve the farm-out agreement. And he further admitted at the trial that all of these terms match. Where were the other terms to be agreed upon if they weren't put in the letter? The only thing that's left is this business about providing a mutually acceptable agreement can be reached. And counsel can argue till the world looks flat. But the only evidence they got in at the trial And the only evidence that the Court of Appeals had to work with was that the man that wrote this letter, the very man that wrote this letter, said that by that language, he meant a joint operating agreement. And what that blew up on them was when I pulled on them in front of the jury that is with city service, they didn't have a joint operating agreement, but they still owed from half the whole. And suddenly that position became untenable, but it was too late. The jury was fixing to go out and vote. Now, does that piece of evidence sound to you like a man who's only trying to cash a breach of contract? So what they've done is, after all that's been done, and after that little story blew up on them, and that excuse for breaching this contract, breaching their fiduciary duty blew up, now they come up with another. The problem is, it's not supported in evidence anyway. Now, on page 536, volume 2 of the statement of facts, the man is asked,
"You testified in your deposition, did you not, Mr. Dove, that what you meant by mutually acceptable terms was a joint operating agreement. Is that correct?" "That's correct." "And now they want to embroider on that and say, oh no, that's some initial units and test wells, and that's all sorts of things, and commencement dates." That ain't what that man said in his trial. That ain't what the jury heard. That's just wrong, and it's contrary to the record, and the Court of Appeals has adopted a brief and read state of facts. Now, there's more to it than that. The expert not only testified of the contract, but all this business about commencement date. You know what commencement date is? You write a verdict, you write a judgment. It's a reasonable time. That's what the industry uses. It's custom usage of the trade. You're exactly right, Justice Ray. The oil business don't work. Lawyers and land people sitting there attaching copies of leases and putting them with letters and sending them off. And Getty does business. Let's take it the other way around. Let this decision of the Court of Appeals stand. In 2 years, I'll be back with landowners whose land has been drilled and held by production with one of these letter agreements. Now the oil companies are trespassing because they didn't have the right to be there, and they all that unpaid royalty in hundreds of millions of dollars. That old sword cuts both ways. Because that's the way they've been doing business, and Getty Oil Company ought to be bound by it. And that's what the expert was testifying to. The implication left with you that Blevins and Getty had nothing to pay, but remember now, these leases were expiring. They were going to expire in October. And the attitude that was displayed when Blevins' letter after they drilled that dry hole came in, they dry hole this land, they wasn't going to drill it. This says so right down here. Because the dry hole, Getty Oil Company has no plan to drill this acreage, and all of a sudden they get a godsend. Poor little Blevins out there is willing to put up the money to get this drilled, and they're not going to have to pay any delay rentals or anything else. They're going to keep their leases alive. So that don't seem like Getty's getting such a bad deal. They're going to spend a nickel. They're going to keep these leases alive, and if it hits, they're going to share the profit. That's a pretty good deal. Now look at the position of the parties. What did Getty do? Knowing that the lease was going to expire in October, they could have gone in the top lease. Displaying on this exhibit, you see that that would raise not a hair. And Getty, Blevco told the truth and was up front, said, "Here's what we're going to do, here's where you missed it, let's do it this way." And they got taken advantage of it. Getty wasn't going to drill this, but Blevco drilled those other wells. And that's what they did to him, and that ought to be punished. And that's the reason that these arguments that they're making will not hold up. Blevco at the top lease, they could have any number of things, but they chose to deal fairly with Getty, and they got taken advantage of it. When Getty saw the other wells being drilled and saw where they missed and saw what the geology was, they reneged on their word. And up to that point, there had been no indication at all that these people didn't have a farm out. And every objective manifestation is that they did. These people signed this year intended for their big one, and they wrote a letter, a series of letters that indicate that intent. And that's the reason we brought this suit. Because they haven't overcome Magro, the presumption in Magro, presuming this judgment as to the contract ought to be affirmed. And because they're now making these ingenious arguments now, before you, before the Court of Appeals, as to that issue that was submitted back there, And they chose not to say a word in the trial court there while they bothered to make 120 other objections. That point's waived, and you ought to affirm that punitive damages here also, because the record cries out that what these people did was they took advantage of my client to who they owe the fiduciary relationship. Even if they're not a joint venture, they're still in such a relationship to each other. In this business dealing, if you don't want to call it a joint venture, they still owe that duty. And that's the duty they breached, and that's what the jury found. While it may be imperfect, there's no reason to correct it because the defendant didn't object to it properly. And he hid his objections that he had and a mountain of other objections. Contract's clear. Contract established as a matter of law. All the objective evidence is that there was a contract.
So you didn't need the expert testimony?
Sir?
How was the contract established as a matter of law?
Okay, the contract established as a matter of law because of this document that shows your intent. We show here...
Apart from your expert testimony at trial.
If you take all the documents together, and you look at the course of their negotiations, and you see that under the testimony of Doug, that he put in that letter every term that he thought was essential to the formation of that contract.
That would be testimony on page 536.
It's on page 114. You set out, there's not any other mention in this letter of any other term, specifically of any other term that Getty is going to have decided before they will farm out, is there? And his answer was, that's correct. There's not any other mention in this letter of any other term that Getty is going to have decided before they farm out. Is there? He said, that's correct. So he chose his term. He put them in his letter. And those letters match up on those terms. These other things are secondary, and the expert explained those away. And he told the custom usage traders can do will supply those elements where they're not inconsistent with the agreements that are actually made. And this case fits the mold perfectly. What elements they decided to agree on, they agreed upon under Scott versus Engel Brothers, they had an agreement that was enforceable as to that. These other secondary elements custom usage of the trade will provide if the parties can agree on. If it's a classic definition of Texas law, and it's been that way since 1867.
I don't want you to go away from here today without knowing that there is a case, and my colleague is going to have to help me a little bit now because I just cannot remember. Remember, Newton Schwartz argued it, and we often decided, but on the submission, breach of contract damage issue and a tort damage issue in the same case, and he made exactly the same argument you did, that the damages were the same, but he only submitted the contract damage issue because he said it was going to be the same. We pulled him out. Maybe somebody can
come in.
Case is mentioned in the Court of Appeals opinion.
Oh,
I believe Justice Robertson wrote on it. Belafonte Underwriters versus Brown, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm aware that there's a problem. To answer your question, Justice Roy, I'm aware that there's a problem with punitive damage aspect. That is a problem. My point is that as a practitioner in the trial court, where you represent an oil company, who the only thing they were going to get was production, you don't have any other special damage to submit. I couldn't think of any, or I submitted them.
Thank you, counsel. The court will take a minute.